Gaw, good morning to you.
Morning.
Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Your Honors. My name is Jim McGow. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bedolla on the appeal of the criminal case out of Hall County. In this case, we're asking the court to really accept the invitation set forth by Justices Stevens, Brennan, Marshall, and Blackmun in the concurring opinion in the Oregon versus Kennedy case. And we're asking the court to acknowledge, reanimate, free the overreaching exception that was pre-existing before the majority opinion in the Oregon versus Kennedy case lobbed that on. So this was a case, and this case really is different than the arguments made by Mr. Stoller in both 2013 and 2015 before this court in the Mohammed cases, because this case, Mr. Bedolla's case, is really that rare and compelling case that Justice Stevens talks about when he talks about the overreaching component of mistrial as it related to double jeopardy. But here's what happened in this case. Nobody objected to jury instructions in regards to the elements of the offense. The jury was instructed for closing arguments. At closing arguments, an argument was made that the time period on count one, sexual assault charge, did not comport with the evidence. The jury then went back and deliberated. After about 2 hours of deliberation, the jury came back with a question. That question was, why are we only looking at a two-year time period from 2009 to 2011 on count one? The court convened for the evening to let the parties review case law on it, and we met the following morning, and at that point the state asked the court to amend the information and also to amend the instruction regarding the elements of that to expand it for another number of years back from 2003 now to 2011 instead of the case that's tried was 2009.
And what does our case law say about how long the state has to amend?
Until verdict is the existing case law. And that's what the judge relied upon in allowing the court to do that. But none of us could find any precedent where anybody had ever asked it to be amended after the case had been submitted. And that's what was different. The defense based its closing argument, at least in part, on the lack of evidence to comport with that particular time period. Now, what could have happened at that point when the state got up for the rebuttal closing is they could have said, hey, we're now asking the information to comport with the evidence. We're asking for that amendment. And I think that would be a whole different situation than when we're trying to cater to a question that the jurors have after the case has been provided to them and they've begun their deliberations. So after the jury was brought back into the courtroom, re-instructed now on the new instruction regarding the elements that included the time period back from 2003 now to 2011 instead of 09 to 11, then the jury in short order indicated that it had reached a verdict. Before that, as the jury came in holding the verdict form, as before that verdict was read, the court granted the defendant's motion for a mistrial at that point. Then the court scheduled it for a new trial, and then we filed the plea and bar. So the question really is, what is the standard here, and what do the cases tell us?
Mr. McGow, does the record tell us what the jury's verdict would have been?
No. Sorry. It does not.
Had the court not granted your mistrial, gone to verdict, we assume a guilty verdict, you would have taken, presumably, an appeal.
Yes.
And assuming that we would have found error, wouldn't you be back in the same position?
Potentially.
So why should we expand the universe where the state is precluded from a new trial under circumstances where, had the court not granted your motion for mistrial, you'd likely be back in exactly the same position you are now?
Well, I would probably have filed another plea and bar. The argument would have conceivably been a little bit different under that scenario, but I would have envisioned, I haven't completely thought that through, Your Honor, but I envisioned that I would have filed another plea and bar and argued that jeopardy had attached, that it was an unusual proceeding to change the rules of the game after the fact, that we didn't have sufficient amount of time to answer or to respond to that change. So I think I would have made the same argument at that time. I think.
And would you have had any supporting authority that would have changed the result on the plea and bar there?
I think to a large extent I'd be pretty much in the same position I am now.
Well, you would have had one more fact.
Yes.
Of a jury having come back finding guilty.
Yes.
You would, in the universe of double jeopardy analysis, you wouldn't have in hand an acquittal.
Correct. Okay. Correct. That certainly would have been different, Your
Honor. That'd be problematic.
Yes. And I think Mr. Castle, to get to the start of your question about the record, I think it's fair with the question that the jury asked to infer from that what the verdict likely would have been if there had not been a change versus what it was likely to be with the change. Of course, that's assuming that the majority of jurors or all of the jurors supported or endorsed that question, but I think that question really underlined the issue that led to this whole kind of procedural issue.
So here's where we find ourselves, right? The defendant moved for a mistrial,
yes,
which was granted.
Yes.
So we're now evaluating the case in that posture. So historically, you're referring to Oregon v. Kennedy. I'm hearing that you're not taking the position that the state provoked this.
I'm not.
But what you're seeking is an expansion that would,
correct,
give a different rationale.
Correct. So there was an expansion that existed before Oregon versus Kennedy. I think United States versus Dorn is the case that's talked about very, very briefly in that case, Oregon versus Kennedy, where there was this overreaching, if there was either judicial overreaching or overreaching by the state in the proceeding itself, then that would be an exception to the double jeopardy issue when the defendant makes it, because normally the rule is if the defendant makes it, it's granted, double jeopardy doesn't apply, and we proceed to trial number two. But the majority in Oregon said, to the extent that there's any inconsistencies here, we are only allowing double jeopardy to apply in situations where the state has done something to provoke.
We used to say goad, but it's more modern to say provoke.
I think the United States used provoke, and I think this court in the two Muhammad cases used the word goad. And I think that's consistent with what other jurisdictions
have. That gets me to the other jurisdictions. How are they receiving this notion of expanding beyond provoke?
I don't have any specific examples of other jurisdictions that have expanded it. I know that other jurisdictions have considered it, but I can't point to any examples at this point where it's been expanded. But it is talked about in that concurring opinion joined by those four justices in the Oregon case, and they talk about how it should be kept for those rare and compelling cases, and this is that case. Unless there's other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Sorry,
Judge.
Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. Upon the signs of error, the district court's order overruling his clean bar, which the state believes the district court correctly ruled on, and we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Here, appellant moved for a mistrial, which was granted, and he does not contend that the state was attempting to goad him into a mistrial. The rule in this case is clear, that when a mistrial is granted at the request of the defendant, double jeopardy bars retrial only if the prosecution intended to goad the defendant into requesting a mistrial, and this rule has been in place for many years. In Oregon v. Kennedy in 1982, United States Supreme Court clarified that retrial is only barred if the prosecutor's conduct was intended to provoke the defendant into moving for a mistrial. In 1976, in U.S. v. Dinitz, the court stated that error by the trial court or the prosecution even would not be enough to bar retrial as long as been clarified in Kennedy was not intended to provoke a mistrial. Appellant admits he was not goaded into requesting a mistrial by the state. To change the exception so that retrial is barred whenever a mistrial granted at the defendant's request because of some action by the state would consume the rule that is now in place. Most of the time when a defendant moves for a mistrial, it's going to be because of something the state did. If appellant's rule were in place, any action by the state that could result in a mistrial, could result in a trial court granting a defense motion for mistrial would bar retrial based on double jeopardy. And this is not in line with the federal rule or any previous decisions by this court. Appellant asked for a mistrial, and he received what he asked for, a chance for a new trial. The district court correctly denied appellant's plea and bar. I have reached the end of my prepared remarks. If there are no questions from this court.
What's the state's observation about the suggestion of expanding the principles in Oregon v. Kennedy or taking some guidance from the minority opinion?
Your Honor, I think that the rule in place has worked so far. This court in I believe it's Muhammad, in 2015 noted that that this court has repeatedly declined to extend the Oregon v. Kennedy exception beyond situations where the prosecutor intended that the misconduct would provoke a mistrial. So I think that this court has been presented with the expansion argument before and has denied it. I think that
is this case factually so unique? Because it appears that the jury was ready to find him not guilty.
Your Honor, I don't think so. I think first we don't actually know the intent behind that question. I think appellant did argue that we can probably assume that it may have been moving towards an acquittal, but we don't know that for sure. I think that there was supporting case law for the state's position that it can amend the information up to the time of verdict.
But that's a little unusual compared to the state where they cut it off at submission.
I'm not totally sure. I haven't looked too far into that because the issue in this appeal is whether the state intended to provoke the mistrial. I think had appellants proceeded to verdict and then taken a direct appeal from that verdict, that would be the issue on appeal. But I think here the issue is retrial barred by double jeopardy because of the defense request for mistrial. And the state does not believe that double jeopardy bars retrial here.
But if the court were to look at this expansion issue, and if there are states that are expanding it on the basis of misconduct by the prosecutor, would that influence your response?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that there was misconduct on the part of the prosecutor here. I think there was case law supporting the state's position that it was able to amend the information up to the time of verdict based on previous decisions.
Right. How about the re-instructions? What's your best authority for we have an amended information and she's pulling her hair out going, okay, now I got to re-instruct.
I understand, Your Honor.
The Bill of Exceptions uses that word, I think.
I don't really have case law authority for this, but to me it seems that that amending of the information is allowed, it would seem to reason that the instructions could be amended so that they comport with the information. But again, I would note that the issue on appeal is not whether that was proper, because appellant chose to move for the mistrial. And had we been on direct appeal, I think that likely would have been assigned an error and would need to be addressed. But because appellant moved for the mistrial and does not contend that the state was acting in an attempt to goad him into that mistrial.
So stay in the mistrial.
Defendant
defendant move for mistrial pigeonhole.
Correct, Your Honor. If there are no other questions, we would request you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute.
1 minute and 24 seconds. Mr. McGaugh.
Thank you. Justice Castle, in answer to one of your previous questions, I had a little more time to think about it and also listen to the arguments of the appellee. And I agree.
That's always a benefit, isn't it?
It is. And to have some time left to do it.
Yeah.
And so I agree with the appellee that if the verdict had gone through, if my motion for mistrial had not been granted, then I would be here arguing that the court needs to reevaluate at what point do we not allow the state or continue to allow the state to amend the petition. Do we allow to do it post-submission or not? And as the appellee indicated, that's really not before the court here. So I think I'd be in a little bit different position, at least from an argument standpoint. And then the other question that
But would, if you were in that position, it would be trial error that if we were then in that hypothetical to reverse, you'd be back for a new trial, wouldn't you?
Maybe. I would be asking you to vacate the conviction completely based upon it, but you would know better what you would likely do in that scenario. So the other question that came up when the appellee was arguing was about the instructions, because not only did the state have to change the petition or complaint or information, but they also had to change the instruction. And if this court doesn't address the issue of when you change the pleadings, then really the cases that talk about if you don't object to instructions, you can't complain about them later, wouldn't apply to the state, because the state could just come in, not object to an instruction, which they didn't do in this case, then come in after a jury comes back with a question and say, you know what, now I want to change the instructions, even though they didn't object to it. So that would still hold for the defendant. If we didn't object to an instruction, then we couldn't complain about it later. But that would be a loophole for the state to change instructions after they didn't.
This is a re-instruction, a new instruction, which the trial judge indicated was given to comport with the new language of the information.
I agree they go hand in hand. But the argument at the time, the state was asking, hey, we want to change not just the instruction, but we want the jury to be, we want to change not only the information, but we want to change also the instruction, have the jury brought back in, and that's ultimately the mechanism that the court used.
It could work the other way. It could work both ways, though, couldn't it? If the information originally charged in part something that wasn't a crime, and the jury was initially instructed on something that wasn't a crime, and defense counsel called that to the court's attention during the deliberations, and the state agreed to change the information, you could end up in the same situation initiated by the defense, couldn't you?
I
agree that may be far-fetched, but it's theoretically possible.
Theoretically, I agree with you, and what's unique about this case is, like your example or this case, there's no precedent.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next case.